This is 4:55 on Friday, November 18th. So here we are, the last day of class before break. When we come back from break, I'm sure you're all aware there are two more weeks of lectures followed by final exams. In those 2 weeks, we will finish up talking about wireless, which won't take very long, and then we'll spend probably the majority of the rest, sort of the bulk of the rest of the time, on security issues. So that's the plan. Meanwhile, you're going to be working on your next project, which is a proxy project. You'll remember that when we talked back in chapter two, we talked about proxies and how they could be used to improve performance. Also, proxies can be used to do filtering, blocking access to certain sites, blocking access to certain content on pages, lots of uses that way. From the perspective of learning about programming with networking, what this project is going to take you through is what's called the forking server pattern, which is commonly used whenever you have a server that is intended to serve multiple clients simultaneously. And so we're going to go over that today, and then we'll go over the project itself. Are there any logistical questions before we start? No takers. Good. All right. So the forking server pattern. We have a process. It was working before. A process with a socket on which it is listening. Right? That's how we start out with a typical server. And we're going to be doing this for TCP servers, TCP-based servers. Oh, that's really not really not quite large enough, is it? Yeah, I will write bigger. Going to be doing this for TCP servers. So how does that go? We have a client out here that does what? It does a TCP... What system call to make that start? What? Connect. Yeah, the client does connect. The server is listening and therefore doing accept. Right? When the client makes that connect call, the accept returns and returns a client. Returns a client socket. So now the client is actually, this is the connect, and now the intention is that the client is going to interact with the client socket over here. Okay? And we did all this before, right? We did this in project one. This was how it worked. So what's going to be different now is that following the accept, the server is going to do a fork or a new thread. If you do this in a threaded way, it will create a new thread. Regardless, the child now, proxy child. You know what? I'm going to call this, for the time being, the server. Okay? I'm going to call this the server child. Okay? So the server child inherits both open sockets. Server child
inherits both open sockets. And goes on to interact with the client. Really, actually, this thing gets inherited too, right? This line gets inherited across the fork in some way. And so now the client and the server child are interacting when they're doing sends and receives. Okay. And so the point of this is that the main server process up there, once all that has happened, another client can come along and do the same thing. Right. So let's add client 2 up here. Let client 1. It does a connect there, and then it gets its own connection here, and server child 2 inherits those. Okay, and the client goes on and interacts with the server child 2. And as a result of doing all this, the point is that all of the clients can be served simultaneously by the different processes. Have you done something like this before in what class? 460, 422. Okay, good. So let's, some of you have. Not, I'm suspicious about that question because some people will say, yes, they've done it, but many people may not have done that. And so for those who've done it before, help your other colleagues understand it. Those who haven't, listen up. So let's go over this. From the client perspective, there's got to be no difference, right? It's essential that from the client perspective, what's happening over on the server in this regard is transparent. We'll call it transparent. There's no difference. So the client code that you've already done, you know how to do, right? Not worry about that. The server code is where the difference is, and so we do accept. Where are my notes? There they are. Okay. Client socket gets accept. No, let me back up. Let me just do the whole server instead of starting at the starting in the middle. Let's start at the beginning. Server one, socket one is socket blah blah blah, just like before. It's a TCP socket. Fill in the parameters. Then we do bind, just as before, to the server port. And then we do listen. And then we do our server loop. Okay, we're still serving is just some condition that lets you shut down the server if you want to. S2, which is like what I called the client socket before, is accept of S1. And then once we get to that point, is where we do the fork. All right. Now, when fork is equal to 0, which process are we in? Child process, right? We no longer need that original socket. So let's close it. Just as good housekeeping behavior, we'll close S1. And then the child process code is essentially while still talking to current client, send, receive, compute, whatever. Okay, and when you get there, close S2. Because then we're done with that. All right, and if we're not in the child, what are we in?
We're in the parent.
In the parent, we have no use for the socket that we received, that we got as the result of the accept. So we close that. That's the first thing we do. It's important to do these closes, especially this one, because if you don't do the close, as the server runs, it will accumulate open file descriptors, and then you run out of available descriptors, and then it breaks. Okay. So this one in particular is essential. That one's essential. Like I said, it's good practice, but you probably won't get burned by them. Why not? Because that process runs briefly to serve a single client and then goes away. When it goes away, the sockets get closed. But this parent process is a long-running process. It will be there essentially as long as the server lives. Every time you connect to it, you accumulate another socket unless you close it. Okay? So that close is essential. And then so this is only going to matter if you, that's the while loop, and that's the main. So now, if you're doing this with actual forks, as opposed to with threads, there's another resource in the system that has to be managed, and that's the availability of processes. And in at least Unixy systems, the way things are defined to work is that when you create a child process, you're responsible for cleaning up after it. You can't ignore it forever. Right? If you don't clean up after it, it will sort of hang around in what's called zombie state. If you do a PS and see a Z in your PS, that's a zombie process. It's not quite dead, but it's not alive either. And so you have to clean those up. So here's a little bit of code for doing that. We keep track of, now why is this not writing? Child count plus plus. So we have a variable that we have in the parent process that we increment whenever we create a child, and then we write in the parent whenever we create a child, we go into this loop. Kind of a magic incantation, actually. I I'll explain what's going on here. W Nohang, yeah. So, and one more curly brace, I think.
Now, why? I'm not remembering.
So, now I have to look something up. It's a detail, but it may be an important detail, so let's look it up. Wrong section. Man 4? I'm looking for the documentation for the wait PID system call, and I got documentation for some library's version of it. I want the actual system call, and the system calls are...
Is it just wait and the Xcode status?
Okay. Okay, so wait PID. Yeah. Right. Okay, that's what I wanted to make sure of, is that this first argument of minus one is correct. Good. All right. So I'm happy with this. So what does this wait PID thing do then? The meaning of this call right here, wait for any child to complete, and when it does, wait PID will return and fill in the status of that child, whether terminated normally or abnormally. We don't care, right? So we pass null as the pointer to the status field. And then we use this other argument which says, I don't really want you to wait, right? This is, the name of the system call is wait, and this argument says don't actually wait, but rather just tell me. And so what is this ends up meaning is just tell me about some process that terminated, some child process that terminated. Tell me its PID. Okay? And if no child has terminated, since I'm saying don't actually wait, return zero, telling me that no child has terminated. And so the effect of this loop is to go through and what's called reap the children that have died. It's just really ugly images, but reaping the dead children. So, yeah, really ugly. I hadn't really thought about how ugly that image is. But that's what this loop does. It just goes to tells the operating system, I don't care anymore about that zombie process. Ignore it. And because I use WNohang here, when I get to the point where I've taken care of all of the currently existing ones, existing zombie children, then I break out of the loop. Okay? So every time I create a child, I check for zombie children and take care of them. And that's soon enough, right? I mean, you might think, oh, I ought to take up care of a zombie child as soon as it happens. You don't need to. There's enough processes in the system that letting them hang around until the next time you create another process, which after all is the thing that consumes a resource, it's okay to just take care of them at that point. Okay? So that's the... I suppose this... If you really wanted to be careful about this, you might move this loop up ahead of the accept, right? Which would say, I've taken care of all of the zombie children before the point where I do an accept. But, or even better, would be after the accept, just before doing the fork. But this is fine. Don't do it at that point. Okay? So that's the only sort of tricky thing here about the server pattern.
Now, let's talk about proxies.
Dr. Hill.
Yes.
Before we move on. When PID returns zero, that means there actually is a zombie child.
No, when PID returns zero, there's no zombie child. Okay.
So you're just breaking at that point.
So at that point, we don't want to keep looking for zombie children because there aren't any more at this point, right? So when PID, when wait PID returns greater than zero, then it's actually the process ID of the child. We don't care about those, so ignore it.
Okay, so we're not actually like cleaning them up. We're just getting to a point where there's no children.
Well, cleaning them up means that we have waited for them,
okay,
right? We have waited for them from the operating system perspective. Once we do that, it's our problem and not the operating system's.
Okay.
So, fine. Okay, add a page. Proxy. A proxy server is... one of these servers, we connect to it, it forks, this is our server, it forks, inheriting this connection, right? So now the client is really talking to that one, and this one is closed. Our web server over here is doing whatever it's doing. So once the client has connected to the proxy server and the child process has been forked, the whole trick is that the child process is now going to make another connection to the actual server. Okay, and things that are sent here get forwarded here. Things that are sent here get forwarded back there. And the proxy server, because it's in the middle, gets to look at all those things and perhaps make changes. Now, the proxy server that you implement is going to not do anything terribly interesting. It's basically only going to tell us, it's going to print on its standard output the headers that go by. So you just get to see what the headers are. Oh, that's a good thing. It will do a little bit of manipulation on the headers just for its own convenience as you're getting started. But hopefully by the time you finish, even that manipulation will go by because you'll have implemented enough functionality in the proxy server that you won't need to manipulate the headers. I'll explain why you have to manipulate the headers to get started. Questions about this? Yeah, Jared.
The proxy server is kind of work like that.
Kind of work like that. Well, yeah, there's a strong analogy there, right? That there's something in the middle that sees every message from one side, passes it on to the other side. When it comes back, it passes on.
Yeah. There's nothing in there.
There doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. Obviously, the the connection that's made here depends on what request, what server the client was requesting from, right? So this connection to the proxy server is typically defined in your browser by the proxy server setting, right? And all connections or some class of connections will be sent to the proxy server. But who you go to after that depends on what you see in the request. If you go back and look at the HTTP protocol description in chapter 2, that will be helpful. And you probably will also want to actually look at the HTTP standard as well before you finish. Okay, now I think it's this one. Yes. So I just explained the role that the proxy server has, and if you think about it, you're going to see that in fact the proxy server captures in one program both the server behavior and the client behavior. Right? Starts out as a server behavior, listening for a connection. That happens. It's still got to play that role of server with respect to the web browser. But it also has to become a client with respect to the web server. Right? So it's got both of these things going on at once. I explained why they're used, pass everything along, and logs the headers so that you can look at them. I'm not very good at driving this program, unfortunately, it seems. Okay, this is another one of those projects where I really want you to do it in a language that you are comfortable with. If that language is not on the list here, let me know. And it's just a matter of making sure that we're able to look at the code and make some sense of it. But any of those would be fine. For many of these languages, there are libraries available that will essentially implement HTTP server, HTTP client. I don't want you to use those. Okay. So you gotta program the part about parsing the HTTP request, parsing and handling the HTTP request yourself. I think we've had groups of size, either individual or groups of size 2. If you want to do groups up to size 3 for this one, that's okay. Again, it's perhaps good for you to have somebody to talk to about this. It does impose coordination problems, I recognize, but I think having somebody to talk to about it and breaking up the work is seriously helpful. As before, you know, what I want to see is the source code, the make file, your analysis of the output. What this says in a lot more words. Please don't turn in binary files and other things. They just gum up the works. Okay. So what does it do? Well, it should be pretty obvious. It accepts connections from web clients. Upon accepting connection, it forks another server process to
handle that client, and then it then in that child process it actually reads the request from the socket coming from the original client, figures out what server, what port the client is wanting to connect to, does that on their behalf, sends the request onward with modification if necessary, receives the answer back. The answer will come with some headers, print those headers on the output, and send the answer on forward.
So let me tell you.
I have. You're going to describe the behavior on three different servers. The Clark's website is very simple. It doesn't do anything complicated. www.cnn.com is really complicated. It's the one that always poses the hardest challenges in terms of getting the page fully rendered because it uses some tricky stuff. Okay.
The modifications. The modifications arise because in HTTP 1.1, remember, a connection is reusable. And so that means that having sent a request to the server, you're going to get back an answer to that request. Well, let me put it this way. You can send multiple requests to a server, right, without waiting for the response with HTTP 1.1. So I send multiple requests to the server, I'm getting back multiple responses. What is the boundary between the responses? You've got to know because you've got to be able to identify when the headers start for the second set of responses. So there are a number of ways that you can know this. In HTTP 1, the easy thing is without reusable connections, you send a request, you get back the answer, the server closes the connection, you read 0 bytes, and you know you're done. Right, that's the HTTP 1 style of doing things. And this header modification trick is essentially to recover that very simple behavior. We force the server to close the connection after serving one request. And we tell the server that we're only going to use it for one request. And the way we do that is by modifying the headers. So amongst the headers, there likely will be connection, and the XX here would typically be keep alive. There would be connection keep alive, there would be proxy connection keep alive. Just delete those from the headers. Don't send them onward. And instead, send a connection close header to the server. And similarly, when the server replies, there will be connection keep alive headers in there. Delete those, replace them with connection close, and then once you do that, you can just trigger off of the end of stream indication of reading 0 bytes. Okay, so that's it. But that's not full behavior. Where is it? Yeah, I'm looking for
Just down there.
It's down here.
Yeah.
There it is. Okay. All right.
Just a way to get started. Your final code should fully support HTTP 1.1 reusable connections. You have to take account of content length in that case because with HTTP 1.1, I send a request and I get back a response. One of the headers is content length, and that tells us how many bytes there are going to be in the response. And then when I get that many bytes, I know I'm done. The trick that people will
sometimes struggle with there is knowing when to start counting. Right? You got the headers, right? Something, colon, something, something, colon, something, something, colon, something. The headers end with two character turn line feeds. And the content starts after that. Okay? So that's where you got to start counting. If you miscount the content, or you count it from the wrong place, you will start absorbing headers as part of the content. You get really, the code will get really. So just pay attention to that. The other thing, the other one that you need to support, and you have to look this up yourself, is what's called chunked transfer encoding. The problem with this is tricky. You've done this before.
The chunked
encoding, yes. It's not really so bad, right? It's sort of just another loop that does content length repeatedly. There's something like content length repeatedly. Okay, so don't get too scared by it, right? You're a computer scientist. The computer science way of doing this is just another loop, right? Just another loop, just or a nested loop. So chunked encoding is used by servers when they don't know how big the content is going to be before they start sending it. If you think about it, for content length, you have to send as part of the header how many bytes you're going to send. So you have to know how many bytes there are before you can start sending any bytes. Chunked encoding lets servers say, here's a chunk of the output, here's another chunk of the output, here's another chunk of the output, how big it is, and then when they're done, they say, and there are no more chunks. Okay? So, it's, you know, just write a little bit more code. It's not that bad.
But I try to ease you to get there. Suggestions, just develop a forking server that accepts client requests and doesn't make any connections to servers. Just get that one. The response it sends can be anything you want. Just, what was the request? Whatever. Just a very simple thing. That'll get you a large way along the way. Printing out the headers in both directions is very helpful, and making sure that you label. I haven't defined what the formatting around the header should be, but make sure that you somehow make it possible for you to visually identify what was the client request and what was the server response. And as things get more complicated, what was the client request and what was the corresponding server response? Because you're going to start being able to send multiple requests and then get back responses that come after the requests have been sent. So just you know, a little bit of attention to the messages that you print will help you. This is not about my requirements about this. This is about you being effective in knowing what's going on in your code.
So there's code out there for doing this. You're not supposed to use it.
Doing forks, can we understand like a thread pool?
You can use threads. Okay. Yeah, right. You can use threads. If you use threads, it will be a little bit different. You don't have to worry about the reaping business if you use threads, because the garbage collector will take care of your dead threads for you.
A thread pool.
You're making it way too complicated.
Well, we already have like two.
You already have a thread pool? Fine. Thread pool. But a thread pool is. As implementing a thread pool is overkill for this.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's okay. So is the whole proxy server in some ways.
Okay, other questions? Let me show you one other thing.
No, I saw the violation of this rule would give you an F in the course, and I thought you meant the not to use any like standard libraries, otherwise you'd get an F in the course, and I thought, wow, that's a little like.
No, don't use anybody else's implementations
right.
of proxies and servers. Okay? That's what it's saying. Start early. Yeah, this is not one that, again, that you can do overnight at the end. I think no matter how good a programmer you are, this is not doable that way, because you will find that you don't understand enough about HTTP and HTTP 1.1 when you start. So you're going to be learning about that as you... You're going to be acquiring learning about that from the mistakes you make in the code. Very likely. So don't save it for the end. Remember, post is sending data to the server. That's a different kettle of fish, but not very different. So a README file that tells us how to make it, a make file or something else that will actually make it, and then your analysis of the headers that you see. Okay. But I wanted to show you one other thing. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Actually, there may be multiple other... We may not get through all of this today. I have to show you. Let's go to... What are they called now? Options. I thought they were called preferences.
Advanced on the bottom.
Advanced on the bottom. Thank you, sir. Network. That's what I want. connection settings. You will want to use manual proxy configuration, localhost, typically. You run the proxy on the same machine where you are working with this. And the port number is a port number of your choice. Doesn't matter. Leave the other ones blank and don't check the box that says use for all protocols. We're getting into heavy duty, way beyond what we're going to do in this course if you check that box. So don't check that box. okay. I would suggest that you have both Firefox and Chrome installed. While you're doing this, set up the proxy server for one of them and no proxy server for the other one. And then use the... set up the proxy server in Firefox. And in Chrome, use the developer tools to see the actual traffic that is being sent by the browser when you visit a particular page. That may well be helpful. So let me see if I can drive the Chrome developer tools to open up. Where do they live? More tools. Developer tools. And here. And you go here. It tells you all the things that were retrieved in order to fetch that page, and it tells you what the headers were, and it tells you what the content was, and tells you how long it took, and all those good things. Okay, so that's Chrome's How do we get there? It was Chrome, more tools, developer tools, and turn those on. And that is very helpful because you're going to want to know what the client sent in the way of headers, and you're going to want to know what the client received in the way of headers. I'm pretty sure.
If you're really, really good, you don't need to know those things. But I always need to know those things. If you can read the spec and say, "Oh, I perfectly understand what all those headers are going to be," after reading a 50-page spec, or have to read the whole 50-page spec, internalize it all, and then be able to answer any question that arose. Whereas my scheme is take the spec, look at the relevant part, and then fill in my knowledge around it as I find the gaps. Okay? All right, any questions about this? So it's due the last day of class before finals week. When is our final in here?
On Tuesday.
On Tuesday?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. I like that. So yeah, get it done. Get it done before final week, if you can.
Is the final cumulative?
The final will. Okay. The question is the final cumulative? The usual balance in the final is that about an hour's worth of it is for the new material, and about half of it is for the new material, and about half is over the other two tests. Anything else? Let's go eat turkey. almost a week from now. Enjoy ourselves in the meantime.
So on the homework, you had a note. R10 is in fact R10, right?
It's really R10, yeah.
When I saw the note, I was like, okay, meant to do that, but I didn't want to check.
It really is R10. It's the first new question I have assigned, yes.
So are we kind of just pretending that there's a